Blog Talk Radio.
Clap your hands for Angela.
Today's interview is with attorney Robert Petillo. Robert Petillo ran for office in 2012 for the Georgia House District 53 in Atlanta, Georgia. He is also an attorney. He represented people in a case against Ms. Paula Deen. He has his own show, his own commentary show. Most of you may have possibly seen him on Mr. Roland Martin. This gentleman here is very intelligent, very smart, and I consider him a civil rights activist. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Despite all the things you're doing, which are great, I know you on CBS Radio and News Talk. You have the Atlanta station also, WALKAM 1380. But the main reason I have you on the show is because of what you said when I saw you on TV. I would like to know, why do you believe that the civil rights monuments should stay?
You mean the civil rights monuments or the Confederate monuments?
Yes, the Confederate monuments. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think what's important is that we don't get lost in the forest for the trees. And by that, I mean in Georgia, probably about 15 years ago, we had this big fight over the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag was part of the state flag of Georgia, and the flag of Confederacy was the official flag of the state of Georgia. And so the coalition of African-American ministers, civil rights activists, progressives all got together and fought alongside Governor Roy Barnes in order to get the flag changed here in the state. And as a result of that, you ended up with such a strong backlash that Democrats lost complete power in the state of Georgia. Currently, we have a Republican governor, we have a Republican majority in the state Senate, Republican majority in the state House. All the state constitutional officials are all Republican. The Supreme Court of the state is overwhelmingly conservative. So what we lost as a result of the fight for the flag was far greater than anything that we gained. Pretty much we got the flag and they got the state. So when we're talking about removing these Confederate monuments, we have to realize it's not going to come without cost. It's not going to come without sacrifice on the part of the agenda that many are trying to push forward. So we have the option between getting rid of flags, getting rid of statues, or having criminal justice reform. Well, we need to fight for criminal justice reform. If anything, if we really want to change issues around the Confederate monument, we should be increasing their size to include the entire story. Don't just have a statue of Stonewall Jackson or Robert E. Lee. Have a statue of them alongside the people who were enslaved by them. Have pictures and stories from Yeah, we have pictures and stories of people who were killed by the Confederacy. Tell the entire story so that people have a better idea of history. We don't need to be getting rid of history. We need to be increasing it because we have a population that overwhelmingly is ignorant of history. So for that reason, I say there's really no reason to get rid of the monuments. All you're doing is making more trouble for yourself. Instead of that, let's work on improving them so they tell the full story. People who fought, died, were enslaved, were imprisoned, and are the real heroes for surviving that and giving us the opportunities we have today. But just tearing down statues isn't going to achieve anything.
Yes, sir. I agree with you, especially about the part about a generation of people, and some of them might be my age, who don't know history, who don't know what happened back then in the 1800s all the way up to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They are ignorant to that, and I do agree with you on that part because they barely teach Black history here in the South. In the part of the South that I'm living in, they don't teach it. They give it like a snapshot view. It's just like came over here on a ship, talking about Black people, the Africans. They were slaves. They weren't paid. Then they were set free, and then they fought for their civil rights. They got the right to equal pay and education and all those things. That's it. You know, they may spend 15 minutes on Black history. So they don't know. The younger generation especially do not know. They're ignorant to that.
Well, the way I like to say it is they teach it as a Black history fairy tale. They make it seem like one day Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln got together and decided to free the slaves. Then they rode the Underground Railroad driven by Rosa Parks to Montgomery to have a boycott. Then later on that day, they met up at the White House with Kennedy and Johnson to have the March on Washington, do the I Have a Dream speech, and then Obama was president. That's how they make the story of Black folks in this country sound, when in reality, you cut out all of the individuals who, you know, were beaten, fought, died, had limbs cut off, were drowned, dogs, everything under the sun. So instead of getting rid of the history and trying to pretend it never happened, let's just make sure we tell all sides of the story, not just the Confederate side.
Yes, I understand what you are saying. I'm sure other people who will listen to the show later on will understand that too. So what you're basically saying is what I agree with also. Put civil rights monuments besides the Confederacy. Tell the whole story. Instead of taking them down.
Exactly.
That sounds great. That would be good. But there are so many people who say take it down because they're reminded of history. Well, that's the whole point. You should be reminded of history. You should know about your ancestors. You should know how you got to be here in America, how it all started, and where it's at today. Because when people don't know their history, they can be discriminated against, and without even knowing they're discriminated against. You know what I'm saying? They don't know who they are.
Exactly.
They don't know how to fight back legally.
Yeah, and you know, the other issue is that what happens when you remove all permanent references to something is that people pretend it never happened. The same way that you have Holocaust deniers now who claim that the Holocaust never happened, the people who claim that 9/11 was an inside job, people, there are conspiracy theorists out there who will try to change history. So we get rid of every reference to the Civil War, every reference to slavery and the Confederacy. Well, in 50 years, they'll say, well, it never happened. Black folks were never slaves. They were just workers. This was all just a myth that somebody made up. And then our ancestors really will be forgotten. So it's our job to keep that flame alive. Each generation has a responsibility to pass the flame of knowledge forward, and destroying monuments and statues isn't the way to do it. And not just that, let's look at who the people are here protesting and so talking about pulling them down. It's not Black folks. It's not us out there. These are the liberal white kids from, you know, private schools who all of a sudden found a new cause they wouldn't be angry about for a week. And instead of, and so they get out there, cause all kinds of chaos and trouble, then they blame it on black folks, even though we had nothing to do with it. Black folks in the South, we grew up with Confederate stuff all around. We see it every day. Every street, you know, the street next to my house is called Stonewall Manor, because it's named after Stonewall Jackson, a Confederate general. We ignore it. It doesn't affect our daily lives. By bringing attention and all this chaos to it, all you're doing is helping those individuals who want to support the Confederacy.
Yes, that is true. That is very true. You are correct about that. You are helping them. You're because you're leaving the people ignorant to the
mm-hmm.
truth. Where, like you said, people could 50 years tonight could say slavery never happened, and there was all kinds of horrible things that happened during slavery and before slavery. I mean, it was more than just working for free. As much where there was rape, there was murder. It's horrible. It's
mm-hmm.
horrible. And that should not be forgotten. Those people should not be forgotten who went through that.
Exactly.
That should not be forgotten, overlooked, because if it was not for them, we would not even be able to vote. We would not even be able to vote. We'd still be on the back of the bus, and we possibly, if it wasn't for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Miss Rosa Parks, and the many, many unknown faces of people who did not even know me or you, who fought, who marched, led, and some died for people they don't even know to be able to vote, and for their children and grandchildren to be able to vote. People had to die just so you and I could cast the vote.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest issues with it, that we have to look at the sacrifices that were made previously, but also the actual work that needs to get done now by our generation. We have a duty to the people who came before us to keep the fight going. And so when we're worried about, we get worried about things that are interesting instead of things that are significant. Is the Confederacy and the Ku Klux Klan and the Civil War interesting? Sure. Is it significant? No. It doesn't affect your daily life. It doesn't put money in your pocket. It doesn't put food on the table. It doesn't make sure your community is safe. It doesn't make sure your kids have a good education. So instead of focusing this generational energy that we have, the little bit of political capital that we have, on taking down 150-year-old statues, well, let's take that same energy and focus on police brutality, focus on making sure that kids have a safe school in your district, and make sure that gentrification doesn't overwhelm us and force us out of the cities and out of the areas that we live in. There's a lot of things that need to be fought for, that need to be battled for. And simply going around taking out statues isn't going to fix any of them. So that's why I think it's important, crucially important, that we not get distracted by these side issues, not get distracted by the flavor of the week, and instead make sure we focus on where the real battle is, ensuring economic opportunity, ensuring criminal justice reform, fair treatment, ensuring educational equality for our young people, ensuring equal access to health care, tearing down the last vestiges of white supremacy and Jim Crow in society. These are the things that we need to be fighting for and fighting about. And let them give us educational opportunity, fair housing, fair employment, then they can keep all the statues they feel like. I think that's a fair trade. Fair trade ain't no swindle.
Yes, that's right. I agree with you. That is what we should be fighting for, fair housing, fair pay, right, no discrimination in the work field and the education field, because right now it seems like the current, well, always has been, in my opinion, they've always, between the killings, that's always by the police, that, in my world, that's always went on. That's common knowledge. Lynching, shootings,
exactly.
Its origins come all the way back from when the African, the Black Americans were set free. It goes, that's when they're called police, but the origins, they were originally Ku Klux Klansmen, and they were the Democrat Party. So, please talk.
Yeah, what people have to remember, well, because there's this whole new push about, well, Democrats were the party of racism, Democrats were the party of the Confederates, Democrats were the party of Jim Crow and the Klan. That's all true, but we have to remember that for African Americans, party identity is irrelevant in America. We have never been a people who have been defined by political party. We have no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. We have permanent interests. So there was a time where Democrats were the party of racism and oppression. Then there's also been times where Democrats were the party of civil rights and the party of equality and anti-lynching. There have been times where Republicans have done great things for the African-American community. There have also been times where Republicans have fought for segregation and fought for the diminution of the African-American community. So instead of thinking about things in these broad these broad, almost comic book turn between good and evil, friends and enemies, we really have to take the fight back and understand that what we're really fighting about is the concept of making sure that we can advance as an organization and that as a group, as a social circle, because otherwise we get distracted by side issues again, as we said, where we're not advancing forward. Instead, we're simply falling apart.
Yes, I agree with you on that, on all of that. You are 100% right. I cannot disagree with you. And like you said, put civil rights monuments next to the Confederate monuments. And I also try to help change the law. Some of the laws that work against and placing people in office like you, and which I don't know if you're ever going to run again, but people like you who have the interests of us. You get what I'm saying? Not just, yeah. And not necessarily just black people, but have vote, but understand what's going on within the criminal justice system, with discrimination. All of those things. And who better to put in office than someone that has that understanding?
Well, you see, this is part of the issue of the electoral process in this country, because it's not meant to get the best people into office. It's meant to get the most obedient people into office. By that I mean that when I ran for office back in 2012, one thing that I found out was that you don't campaign to voters, you campaign to donors. That because of the cost and the price of everything from yard signs and mailers, campaign offices, staff, all these other websites, social media, all these things, because of that, you spend most of your time just trying to raise money. And when you're out here begging for money from people, well, then the people who are writing the big checks are expecting favors to be cast in there with it. So the people who are the most successful in politics are the people who can convince these donors that, yes, if I get into office, I'm going to do exactly what you tell me to do. You can count on my vote for these agenda items. You can count on me to vote against these agenda items. So we don't end up with real new revolutionary ideas coming into the political process, because those ideas don't end up getting funded. This is why you'll see that things like our congresspeople, for example, on the Democratic side, the top three Democrats in the House, Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn, and Nancy Pelosi, are combined 221 years old between the three of them. That they are 75, 76, and 77 years old, because they can stay in office because they have the same agenda as these donors, and no one else, unless you're an independent millionaire or billionaire like Donald Trump, is hard to break through the political process and actually be able to win. So this is why it's difficult to get good people to run for office, because they don't want to spend that much time selling out to donors. You don't want to spend that much time campaigning just for money, and you don't end up actually being able to achieve things once you're in office, because the entirety of the body is already there. They can't be be swayed by debate. They can only be swayed by whoever's writing the next check for them.
Okay, Attorney Petillo, what is your thoughts about the Electoral College?
I think the Electoral College is absolutely necessary for the African American community. We shouldn't get distracted by many of these, you know, left wing talking points where they say, "Oh, well, we need to go to the popular vote." You only say that because you keep losing by the popular vote. What the Electoral College does is give small states and minority communities more of a voice than they would have otherwise. If we just had, if we got rid of the Electoral College, then every election would only be New York, Boston, Texas, Florida, California. That would be the entirety of the U.S. election because that's where most of the population is at. The entire rest of the country would have no voice, would have no, they wouldn't campaign there. Their issues wouldn't be brought to the table. It would be just a wasteland in the middle because where the big cities, the money, and the population centers are would have all of the power in the United States. So even though people are upset that Trump got elected without winning the popular vote, what he did do was go to the state and go to the states where the Democrats weren't campaigning yet and talking to people, meeting with them, and putting together a strategy that would get him to the electoral number even if he didn't have the popular vote number. Now, Hillary, if she wanted to win, she could have gone to Flint the week before the election and said, "Well, we're going to make sure to get you water." She only lost Michigan by 30,000 votes. So if she had gone there, she would have won the election. She could have gone to Charlotte, where 200,000 people were in the streets after a police shooting, and said, "Well, we're going to do something about police shooting." She didn't. She lost North Carolina by 100,000 votes. She could have gone to Milwaukee, to Wisconsin, and said, "We're going to do something about police brutality in your state." And she only lost that state by 70,000 votes. So the reason that she lost isn't because of the Electoral College. The reason she lost is because she never put together a campaign strategy. She never reached out to the population she needed. And she thought that she could just win with the coastal elites instead of having to go into the middle of the country. And ultimately, that's why she ran the worst campaigns with Mondale.
All right. I understand what you're saying. It was not the Electoral College. Mr. Trump, President Trump, and he won the electoral votes because those states voted for him. Okay, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what you're saying. That makes perfectly good sense. So what is your point of view about the $20 bill and having Ms. Harriet Tubman on one side and ex-President Andrew Jackson on the other side? What do you think about that?
You know, it's an interesting thing, currency in this country, because if you go to other countries, it's far more diverse, far more narrative of a society. I think that it's definitely good to have something besides an old dead white guy on money. I don't understand why Andrew Jackson still has to be included, particularly because Andrew Jackson was an enemy of the federal banking system. Remember, he destroyed the Second Bank of the U.S. By revoking its charter and placing money into the Bank of Northern Virginia. So he was never a fan of the federal banking system, not to mention that Native Americans won't spend $20 bills because of what Andrew Jackson did with the Trail of Tears and basically genocide against the Native American communities. So I wish we had taken the full step of just saying that we're going to just have someone besides Andrew Jackson on the money. I think that we will be better served by having rotating pictures on all of the currency. That, one, for security reasons, makes it harder to counterfeit it when you're changing the individuals on a regular basis. Secondarily, there's a lot of stuff that's going on in history, and we're using these this currency as living documents. And as living monuments to the history of the country, by rotating them, we have a chance to tell the story of all Americans. We can put Native Americans on the currency. We can put Cesar Chavez on the currency. We can put Arab Americans on the currency. We can go through the entire panoply of history. So I think Harriet Tubman is a good first step. I'm amazed it's taken until, I think it'll go in circulation 2020, taking that long for it to happen. But I hope it'll be a harbinger of more things to come.
Yes, yes. Well said. Well said. Well said. All right. So the economics, fair pay, fair housing. What can we, as a nation of people, help to do to bring this process about fair, equal pay, better pay, and housing? How does that come about? What would you suggest?
Well, let's take the two issues separately. Let's start with the fair housing component. With fair housing, what we're talking about is whether or not poor people or low-income people will have access to urban environments. So remember, about 50
yes.
years ago, say in the the late 60s, early 70s, is when the big push for the suburbs started. So rich white people left urban environments, left them to minority communities, and just left them to decay and to rot. This is where we saw the big rise of the suburbs of Levittown after World War II, and areas like that. And so what happened was you had public housing in urban areas that left big areas of no economic development. The inner cities decayed. It became, you know, everything that all the nightmares of the 70s and 80s, crack epidemic, AIDS epidemic, so on and so forth. What happened in the late 80s and early 90s and into the 2000s was the push for gentrification, which is because property values had diminuted so greatly in inner city environments. The next generation of the suburbanites got tired of driving into downtown an hour to work every day, so they started redeveloping urban environments. That's where you start seeing old black neighborhoods turning into condos and lofts, coffee shops, and all those wonderful things we associate with a middle-class urban environment today. But with that, it displaced the poor people who lived in this urban environment previously. Well, and as this process has continued, it's resulted in many people having no access to transportation, no access to goods, no access to jobs, and really being pushed off into suburban environments where they're not suited. There's without access to educational resource, transportation resources, and everything along those lines, what ends up happening is people get stuck out here in the country, and they the countries become the new slums. Instead of having public housing for poor black folks, instead you end up having trailer parks or extended stay hotels where they live at because they don't have anywhere else to go. So on this
yes,
issue of public housing
is
so true.
That is so true about rural areas. I'm in a very rural area. I'm like 30 minutes from Alabama. So, I'm in a very small. That is so true. They did everything. People can't afford anywhere, and this is supposed to be one of the cheaper places to live.
And they can't afford things.
There's so much discrimination and so much. And basically, people just don't care. That's my point of view. Hopefully things
will
change.
Yeah, and so in order to address that, what has to happen is that you have to have input from poor people on urban planners, on the government, in order to say, well, for all this development you're doing, for all of these, every time you put up a coffee shop or a dog park or something, you can also put some low-income housing or housing subsidies there. Because otherwise, we're going to end up stuck on the same plantations we left after Reconstruction, because we won't be able to afford anywhere else to live in these urban environments. So this is why fair housing, housing that has access to the entire resources of the community, this becomes transformative. When you give people access to fair housing. They have access to better educational opportunities, better employment opportunities, and they have the actual ability to lift themselves out of generational poverty. Versus when you don't do that, then you end up with an entrenched class of the poor. And when you when this entrenched poor class doesn't have the ability to contribute to the economy, doesn't have the ability to contribute to contribute to lifting themselves out, so you end up investing more in social services, you invest more in police, you invest more in drug treatment. So it's an entire sickness of the community that happens when you fail to invest in making sure that people have access to housing, education, and transportation. So that's one, making sure the city planners have subsidies, they have areas set aside in the most prosperous communities where poor people are actually able to live. Otherwise, you end up with the haves and the have-nots. You have these beautiful crystal cities and then the barbarians outside of the gate clamoring to get in that you just bring into work and then send home at night. And that plays into fair employment and into the ability to get, you know, living wage and equal wages. Because once you have fair housing, then you have the ability to get to jobs that pay a fair wage. Once you have the ability to get to a job that pays you a fair wage, that allows you to to compete in the market economy, to start your own business, to build up your own community, to pull yourself out of the of poverty and get involved in the actual society.
Yes.
So it's an entire process that we have to fight for, not simply a 1-2-3 step. I think too often people, because we don't teach the complexities of the civil rights movement, what ends up happening is people think that the process was simple. Martin Luther King got up there, they had a couple marches, and then after that everything was cool. Well, no, that's not how things worked. You, instead of just having a couple marches and everything being cool, what really had to happen was people had to fight and die and push legislatively. They had to think about issues in a deep and probative manner. And because we don't teach this, people really think that the process is supposed to be easy and simple. And that's why it's been hard for us to sustain any movements in the last few years, because as soon as things get hard, people lose interest. They go right back to what they were doing before instead of fighting for actual progress.
Yes, and the rural areas are getting poor. There are some Black Americans, I'm not going to lie about, there are some that are making it, and there are some students who are still going to the NBA and NFL. That's all happening. There are still Black homecoming queens and Black student presidents. I have a sister. She's there in Georgia. She did very well. Very, 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 very well. There at Oglethorpe. Did very well. It's like 15 years difference in our ages, you know, but 16 really. But she did very well, so she made it, you know. But the rural areas are overlooked. The Blacks in the small towns are overlooked. They don't even, I believe, in certain areas in the South, they don't even give a fair population count. They keep certain programs from coming into the areas, certain type of grants.
Right.
And things like that. They do the voting thing where I live at. There's the county I live in. Then another county. And then the county I live in again. That's to keep Black Americans, African Americans from being able to get in office.
Mm-hmm.
In politics.
And it's not just getting them in office, but getting the people in office who have an actual agenda that is a pro-Black, pro-community agenda, and not simply a pro-corporate interest agenda, not just pro-donor agenda. Because, frankly, we got enough folks in there right now. Just because they're your color don't mean they're your brother. I think we've all seen that. And we have a lot of elected officials right now who have no interest in, as you said, the needs of poor America, rural America, and Black America in general.
Yes, sir. That is correct. That is very correct. Unfortunately, that is very true. They have their own agenda. They're not really for poor people, poor black people, really rich black people. They're more in it for themselves, not really to help better things. Where I live at, like I was saying, I'm not going to say where I live at, but I see a lot of wrongs with the police.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on that I can't really speak on, but it's not, it's bad. I can't go public with this, but it's bad.
Mm-hmm. A big part of the problems we have currently is that people who are supposed to be on our side are really just out there for themselves. The biggest differences in this country aren't racial, they aren't cultural, they're economic. So rich black folks and rich white folks have a whole lot more in common and a whole lot more suitable interest towards each other than poor black folks have with rich black folks. So the ruling classes in this country have a vested interest in keeping this racial divide going. You'll never have poor blacks and poor whites and poor Latinos getting together and fighting for their rights. Instead, they have the poor black folks, poor white folks, and poor Latinos all fighting against each other instead, so that they don't ever get together and actually try to change things for their own communities.
That is true. You are correct. And there's fighting among each other. That's not something you're exaggerating on a line about. Instead of pulling together, everybody's fighting against the other instead of trying to help each other get ahead and to figure out ways to better us as a whole. Because if we were more united, we could get ahead faster.
Yep.
And that's what, unfortunately, that's what certain people count on, us not being united, us being against each other. Yeah.
Exactly.
Because here, where I live at, they're still talking about light skin and dark skin within these areas.
It's a hard thing to get over, a hard thing to realize that they keep this division going between you so that they don't have to worry about fighting. As long as you're fighting each other, then they got nothing to worry about. And the minute that we stop, the minute that we can get light skin and dark skin, black and Hispanic, gay and straight, black and white, all on the same team, and realize that the real people we're fighting are the economic or people that were fighting on economic issues, then that's when they really have something to worry about. Until we get to that point, then they know they can continue ruling the country without having to really worry about much.
I understand everything that you're saying. I agree with it all. You're great, Attorney Fotello. You're attorney, author, activist, analyst. You have a radio show. I interviewed you years ago when you were running for District 53 there in Georgia, House of Representatives, and I was happy to interview them, and I'm happy to interview you today. You're so intelligent. Also,
well,
you're welcome, sir. The disabled. What is your input if you're not comfortable talking about people who are disabled and receive government help? What is your input on government help? Honestly,
talk about government help as if there's something wrong with it. Government help helps the entire society, because before we had government help, if you were sick or if you were injured or if you had some kind of infirmity where you couldn't contribute to society, you just died on the street. And I don't think that we want a country where poor people are laying on the streets dying on a daily basis because we don't feel like helping them as a social group. We put all this effort and energy into shaming poor people or into shaming the people who can't take care of themselves. But instead of doing that, we need to be focusing that exact same energy on figuring out how to make sure that they have more resources. The more resources they have, then you put them in a position where they can actually contribute to society instead of being on government assistance or government help generationally. I don't think any of us would like to be walking down the street on a daily basis seeing dead bodies of poor and disabled people or starving people who don't have the ability to care for themselves in the richest country in the world. And the same people who get mad about government assistance now are the same ones whose ancestors came over here and got free housing from the government, who got free land from the government, who were given money to go settle Indian territory. Things along those lines, that it's very convenient once you don't need government assistance anymore to talk bad about government assistance, but you're the same people who, look, segregation was government assistance for white people. When you didn't have to compete against black folks, it was easy to be rich and to succeed in society. Babe Ruth was the best baseball player not because he was good, but because he didn't have to play against Satchel Paige. So anytime you segregate a part of society, you're helping that social group. That's government assistance. Those land grants that people got to settle the West, when the reason they called them the Oklahoma Sooners is because they were able to go settle sooner than everybody else. So if you weren't mad about that, if you weren't mad about all these other parts of government assistance, no, don't be mad now that other people are getting some of it. It's very hypocritical, this idea that somehow as soon as you don't need it anymore, now nobody can have it.
Right. That's what I'm saying. My point of view and my understanding is once you make it, you don't need any type of government assistance of any kind, disability, food stamps, AFDC, assisted living facilities, checks going out to help the poor and the people who really need that assistance. Once you make it, you forget about your grandmother, you forget about your granddad or your aunt, great aunt or your mom's relative. Once you make it, just forget about all of them. And now you're against government help. That's stupid. That's hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
yeah,
people stay in motels and think that is true. There are people who rent out motel rooms. There are they're in Alabama, here in Florida. There are people living in motels for like maybe $200 a week, $150,
mm-hmm.
$200 a week. There are people living that way.
Yeah, because now because we haven't invested in fair housing for poor people. Well, now the really only option in many urban areas is either you live out somewhere in the woods, you know, 20 or 30 miles from civilization, or you live in an extended stay motel, because those are really the only places that you can afford to be at. And that's just not how our society should be working.
Yes, or you live in a rural area that I lived in, a rural area, where there's not a whole lot of opportunity where you have to leave just to be able to make decent
mm-hmm.
wages and live decently. You know, you have a choice between cashier work, restaurant work, teacher, nurse, things like that. But lawyers and doctors are not plentiful. They're not
mm-hmm.
plentiful at all.
So there's an entire societal change that we have to work towards. And until we're willing to make those investments and willing to make those sacrifices, get out of worrying about black and white and worrying about, you know, Republican and Democrat, and really just start talking about rich versus poor, then that's when we'll make some progress. And this is why the
yeah.
media and the ruling class likes to keep you distracted. Somewhere talking about like, oh, well, Trump and Russia and this, that, that doesn't matter. The people who were broke under Nixon were still broke under Carter, were still broke under Reagan, were still broke under Bush, were still broke under Clinton, and on down the line. So until we get out of our heads this idea that that these distractions are the real issues, then we are going to continue to end up in the same positioning and with the same rich folks still ruling the country with impunity from everyone else.
Okay. Thank you, Attorney Robert Petillo. Thank you for agreeing to allow me to interview on Show Talk with Angela Butler, sir.
Well, thank you so much. You know, you were the first person to interview me while I was running for office, so I had to return the favor.
Okay, yes. Yes, I understand. I understand. And I'm proud. It's great things you are doing. God bless you, sir.
No, thank you so much.
Yes, sir. All right, you're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. That was attorney Robert Petillo. Years ago, he was on my show when he was running for representative. The gentleman has been